This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, the shooting of an African-American man by Charlotte Mecklenburg police reveals a level of anger and frustration we've not seen before in the Queen City, with protests turning violent and the governor declaring a state of emergency. An update on what we know about that shooting, the riots that ensued, as well as analysis on how officials and the media have handled this. Mr. Stumpf goes to Washington and gets a less welcoming reception than Jimmy Stewart did. Wells Fargo's CEO takes a licking from the Senate Banking Committee over sales practices in what we thought would probably be the big story in what has turned out to be a very busy week here. Charlotte City Council declines to repeal the ordinance that led to the legislature passing HB 2. That short-circuited Raleigh's promise of a repeal of the law if Charlotte acted first. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. We're joined by WFAE's Tom Bullock and Nick Oxner, reporter for WBTV News from the print edition of our show. Our two Erics, Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer at the Charlotte Business Journal, and Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome back to all of you.
Good morning.
The big story all week, obviously, has been the police shooting of an African-American man by an African-American officer that led to protests and riots. Let's start with the shooting. What do we know this morning that we didn't know on Tuesday afternoon or Wednesday morning?
Nothing. Nothing new has come out. What we know is what I think probably the biggest thing that we know, it goes to what is a key issue here, and that's we know that the family and now the mayor have seen the video, the dash cam and body cam video of the incident. And we've heard for quite some time now, we've heard this from Mayor Jennifer Roberts, we've heard this from Chief Kerr Putney, and now we've heard it from the lawyer for the family of Keith Scott, that it is not definitive, that the video itself is not definitive. Now, Chief Putney says when taken in totality of everything else, he stands behind exactly what the officers did, that they were justified. But the issue seems to be now this video, and it's something that Chief Putney and has said repeatedly, it doesn't look like he's going to release to the public, despite calls by the family, by protesters, by media organizations, that it is in public interest to release it to the public.
And despite precedent in many other cities.
Absolutely.
And despite the law, which he said very clearly yesterday he just doesn't care about. He didn't say, I probably won't release it. Someone asked him, when will you release it? And he said, you should not expect it to be released.
Yeah, it's pretty clear this is not a matter of the law. This is a matter of Chief Putney's choice.
Is that
He's
smart?
Choosing
well, that's,
not to
in
do
fairness,
this.
That is part of the law.
No, it's not.
Well, it's
not yet. It will be, but it is not currently.
October 1, the law goes into effect.
But it is not currently. And this is, and I'm correcting you because
when I
interviewed Mayor Roberts last night, she said, well, the city attorney's office tells us that the chief has the prerogative when to release the video. The chief will have the prerogative in the law that takes effect October 1st, the same law he incorrectly cited on Wednesday when saying that he could withhold it. That's not correct. So the mayor told me that last night. But in the current laws and under which we're operating, there is absolutely no provision where the chief gets to decide when and if the video is released.
This whole thing has revealed some cracks that maybe lawmakers or officials know about and don't talk about much behind the scenes, but most of the public doesn't know about. We had Mayor Roberts on this program yesterday, and I alluded to the different versions of the story that we have from and this is before anybody saw the video, the family story, the police's story, and today with dash cams and police body cams, we do have access to real-time documentation of some sort. So when Mayor Roberts was with us on the program yesterday, I asked her about that. This is all happening because of the shooting of the African-American man by an African-American police officer in the university area on Tuesday. And you told CNN yesterday, as I watched you on CNN yesterday afternoon, that you want transparency. You told them that the police have been or will be showing you the video. Have you seen it yet?
I have not seen it yet.
Why not?
We have a process in place.
You're the mayor.
We are respecting the wishes of the family. Remember, this is a tragedy for the family, and the chief has elected to show them the video first and then begin to show myself and other community leaders.
Does that make sense?
The video.
We have riots in the streets. Does that make sense to A, not let you see the video before the family sees the video, and to not let us see the video? Because if the video demonstrates what the police say actually happened, which differs from a lot of people on the scene, if that video demonstrates the police are telling the truth, wouldn't that stop all of this?
Well, that's something we don't know about when you say if, because we know there are different angles. We know that there can be grainy, some of these videos. We don't know about the distance involved. And so since I haven't seen it, I can't really make an opinion
point.
About that.
That's my process. Point. That's my point, Mayor. I mean, if you haven't seen it, you can't talk about it, and you can't stand behind the police chief necessarily.
Even after I have seen it, I can't talk about it because we have an ongoing investigation. And our policy is when you have an ongoing investigation, you don't release evidence in dribs and drabs. You want everything to have a complete picture before you release that to the public so that we don't have an incomplete picture of what might be the truth.
That's what happened on this program. Yesterday, some people have taken exception to my tone. I wasn't really frustrated with her. I'm frustrated with the fact that the mayor of the city of Charlotte, who has to speak for the city of Charlotte on national television, has not been able to see the video.
Well,
she has to request that.
And the other thing, Mike, that leaps out at me when you hear that clip is the fact that she's saying they don't want to reveal an investigation in dribs and drabs, and yet she and the chief are talking about how the video is inconclusive,
exactly.
Which is putting dribs and drabs out there about the investigation.
If you don't want to put anything out, don't talk about it at all. Either release the video or don't talk about what it shows.
Well, Mayor Roberts was on Anderson Cooper's program, Anderson Cooper 360 on CNN last night after viewing the video.
I actually was able to view that video today, and I am in agreement with our chief as well as the family of Mr. Scott. And both the family and the chief have said the video is ambiguous. It is not clear. When you have a body camera in motion, you have things in the way and obscured views, it is not clear. And I lean toward transparency. I lean toward wanting to release the video. But I also am aware that there is an active ongoing investigation, an independent investigation by the State Bureau of Investigation that is ongoing. And I am trying to strike that delicate balance between transparency to the public, but also knowing that we want that investigation to have the highest integrity. We want it to have all the pieces in place before that is completed. And so I am working with our police chief and will continue to stay in touch with law enforcement and striking that delicate balance as to when that video might be released.
You guys cover crime stories and court trials and things like that. Is there something to be said for that, that you release this ambiguous video that she's described herself as being ambiguous, and maybe you taint the jury pool?
Well, let's start with this.
If there is one.
Let's start with this in a couple of – we were talking about this actually before the show started. Let's go through the arguments directly. If the SBI has some kind of a statement against or a desire that this video not be released because they fear it will taint the investigation, we have not, as far as I know, heard that from them. We're hearing this from Chief Putney and Jennifer Roberts. Number two, if this is in fact ambiguous, that if it takes the totality of the evidence that they have gathered to come to this conclusion, then you could easily argue that releasing this in the interest of public safety and just in public interest in general, that could help calm the situation down. I'm not taking these stances, but I want to lay out the argument. So therefore, if it's ambiguous and you have this totality that Kerr Putney talks about, you're not necessarily tainting the jury pool because you still have the testimony of the officers and these witnesses, which the police have said corroborates their side of the story. Mm. And let's also not forget precedent here. Let's not forget a little bit of recent history. Lost in some of this is the fact that just last year, we had the trial of Randall Carrick for shooting Jonathan Farrell. And we were told ahead of that trial that the dash cam video was a key point of evidence. And when everybody saw that video, I think for just about every person who saw it, there was a slightly different take on exactly what happened that night. It, too, is not definitive. It, too, did not necessarily show anything that could have tainted a jury pool.
And in Tulsa, they released the video.
Exactly.
And it,
yep,
too, is not definitive. You can't see exactly what's going on with that gentleman who was shot and killed by the police officer who has now been indicted.
And yet there are no riots in Tulsa.
And there are
that's
of
why.
And there are plenty of cities where they
where
they release video and you can redact and take other steps if things are too sensitive to be revealed.
Yeah, and I don't want to say, I'm not going to go as far as Eric and say that's the reason there aren't riots in Tulsa. But, you know, I'm not so sure that there is a causal link. But there's certainly.
Well, the police chief or the mayor of Tulsa says that's exactly why.
And that may be exactly the point. But either way, think of the perception from the people who believe that they are part of the aggrieved party. And that is not just the Scott family.
Right.
Clearly, with what we've seen in Charlotte, there is a much broader group of people who find themselves aggrieved by this situation, the situation overall.
But do you find it odd? I mean, I understand not releasing the video to the public before the family sees the video. I think there are sensitivities.
Sure.
That have to be
taken
into account. But the mayor not being able to see the video?
Well, she has no more of a right to view the video than the rest of the general public because she's not a law enforcement officer, and they're withholding it because it's a law enforcement record. But here's a bigger point that I want to make as to why the new line about the SBI ongoing investigation is wrong. They are continuing to just find another bad argument. This is argument number 4 that they've now proffered as to why they can't release the video. All of them have been wrong and not consistent with what the law is. One, CMPD remains a custodian of that record. If we were requesting it from the SBI, then they could withhold it because it's an investigative record. But two, the law currently says if you think it would undermine an investigation, then you have to go to a judge and get the judge's permission to withhold it. And the judge would probably grant it. And yet, no one in the city has said, let's just go file an order so that we can solve this once and for all.
Yeah.
They have, in fact, refused our request for that.
I have to think that you mentioned the Farrell case,
mm-hmm.
Mike. I think the shadow of the Farrell case and the Farrell video is hanging heavily over how Chief Putney and his staff are sort of calculating all this out. Because if you'll remember, the command staff under Rodney Monroe and Chief Putney was a part of that command staff at that time, they made their decision to charge Carrick largely in part, or at least this is what Rodney Monroe said at the time, because of what that video showed. And at the end of the day, after they charged Carrick, you know, we had a trial. It didn't, you know, it
mistrial.
It was a mistrial, wound up being inconclusive. Chief Putney has said that the way that the brass handled that case almost ripped that police department apart because officers, rank and file officers, thought that the brass hung an officer out to dry. Mm-hmm. I think Chief Putney is reacting to that, and that is sort of framing the way that he views what he does in this case, and I think it's causing him to overreact the other direction.
And in the aftermath of that the mistrial, we did not we had some protests, but nothing violent. What's different about this time?
Well, I think one thing is the cumulative effect, the fact that we had Jonathan Farrell, and of course, all of the things that have happened all across the country. I mean, you know, it's not happening in a vacuum. And I think that's one thing you always have to remember when protests turn into violence is it's usually not one thing. It's a series of things that have built up over time, and then it just kind of explodes.
That's a really good point.
The police chief does not work or report to the mayor. He works and reports to the city manager. It would be interesting to know what your thoughts are and if Ron Carley had been the city manager. Ron Carley was here for a while and retired or left or resigned recently. Would he have seen the video? Did the city manager see the video? Does anybody know?
Interesting question.
It is an interesting question. And I would say I don't know how much farther Ron Carley would have gone, but he did have one benefit that Mr. Kimball does not have, which is he did not have interim in his title. And I think that alone would have predicated a different response.
A lot more to talk about with regard to what's been going on in the city the last several days. We'll also try to touch on Wells Fargo in Washington and other things as well as the local news roundup continues. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Hobart Financial Group Incorporated, helping to make retirement decisions that strive to minimize risk and help maintain lifestyles. Details at askhobart.com. And Elon University, welcoming speakers this fall, including Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward, columnist Kathleen Parker, and internet engineer Vint Cerf. Ticket information at elon.edu. Alzheimer's disease disproportionately affects women. Almost two-thirds of Americans with Alzheimer's are women. The same percentage is true of those who provide care for Alzheimer's patients. One of those female caregivers is Kim Campbell. She's been caring for her husband, singing legend Glenn Campbell, and she will join us to talk about her experience. And then we hear from other caregivers and those doing research to figure out why so many women are affected. Monday on this program at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Ongoing protests in North Carolina over the police shooting of a black man. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump clash on national security policy after the New York bombing. And lawmakers sharply question Wells Fargo's CEO over scam accounts.
The News Roundup continues on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking, this is the local news roundup, and we're talking obviously about the big story of the week here and around the country. Charlotte being involved in protests and some rioting and some property damage as the result of a police shooting of an African-American man. Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Nick Oxner from WBTV News, Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer from the Charlotte Business Journal, and Eric Frazier, editorial writer of the Charlotte Observer, are with us. We've been talking about Chief Putney. We probably ought to hear from Chief Putney. He was asked about the video yesterday at his press conference with the mayor, and what he had to say might have been a little disappointing to some people out there.
What I can tell you that I saw, and I was very clear when I talked about this before, is the video does not give me absolute, definitive, visual evidence that would confirm that a person is pointing a gun. I did not see that in the videos that I've reviewed. So what I can tell you, though, is when taken in the totality of all the other evidence, it supports what we've heard and the version of the truth that we gave about the circumstances that happened that led to the death of Mr. Scott.
It sounds a little confusing to me, and I don't think we can clear up the confusion without seeing the video.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why you're hearing all the conversation that you're hearing about this, because you're in the end left with just taking everything at face value. And based on everything that's going on, not only here, but across the country, as I was just saying, I don't think many people are willing to do that right
and
now.
And I believe Chief Putney also said that he could not definitively see if the gun, what he says was a gun, was pointed at the officers in a threatening way. I bring that up because actually Steve Harrison of the Charlotte Observer did a very interesting piece that I think is important to remember here. The family says that Mr. Scott had a book. The police say that Mr. Scott had a gun. Even if he had a gun, this is an open carry state, which means it is perfectly legal for an individual to have a gun in the open, and that includes in their hands. Now, obviously, if police feel threatened, that's one thing, and I am not discounting that. Having a gun pointed at you is not a fun experience, and I support them trying to obviously stay safe. But it matters Mr. Scott was doing.
That's absolutely
with
right.
The gun, if it existed.
And I thought that was a good story too, and I think that's a very important point.
WBTV also reported on this aspect of it. I don't know when this story ran, but
yesterday afternoon.
Okay, essentially, that it's an open carry state, and you don't ask somebody to get out of a car just because they may or may not have a gun.
Well, that's correct. And specifically, the city attorney's office told us yesterday that they were not trying to arrest Mr. Scott at the time of this incident. And they said that in version 3 of why they weren't going to give us the video recording, actually. Mm-hmm. But it kind of begs the question. They were asking him to get out of the car.
Why?
That's the question that's being begged.
What were they doing? And it is, I guess, could be maybe conceivable that they were doing something else, but they haven't said what. And at the time that you start asking him to get out of the car and start engaging him with more than one officer and uniformed and ununiformed officers, it sounds like not a small number of people who were there. Sounds like they were trying to detain him or talk to him or search him or something. And so I think that just raised another question instead of providing any answers.
So this incident on Tuesday afternoon led to peaceful protests at first that escalated into taking over I-85 and closing it down in both directions at W.T. Harris.
I'm not sure it was actually ever peaceful, by the way.
Really?
My wife, Sarah Blake Morgan, also a reporter at WBTV, was there pretty much all afternoon, and she said it got out of hand pretty early. In fact, early in the night, she took a hit from something in the back that was so hard it knocked her down, and that was before, well before they got on I-85.
This is Tuesday?
Tuesday night.
Yeah. Tuesday went bad pretty fast.
And we had a photographer have to go to the hospital and sustained a concussion because he got hit in the head with a rock again before they ever got to I-85.
Yeah, so. It was Wednesday night into Thursday morning where things did start peacefully. And they did. I mean, quite honestly, it seemed like the point early on was to have peaceful protests. And then once everything got down to the Omni Hotel in Uptown at, you know, Trade and College, that's where things really – really started to go south.
Yes, Wednesday night was the worst of it because one protester was shot and now has died as a result of being shot on the street out in front of the Omni Hotel. The police say that it was civilian on civilian. Now that's being called into question by some people who were there. What do we know about that? Anything at all? There's no video of this anywhere?
That's what I wonder. Is there, you know, we have so many cameras uptown now.
Well, not only
know,
that, just
there's got to be some video of that out there somewhere. But yeah, we're hearing from people who say that they supposedly saw it and that it was a police officer shooting a, you know, rubber bullet, and supposedly the rubber bullet hits the guy falls down, hits his head. That's just unconfirmed what we're hearing people say.
And hospitals hospitals released no information?
No, all we know is his name.
Yeah, and I heard the same things on when I was down Wednesday and Thursday night, and the important thing is we don't know, and it's important in situations like this to say what we do and do not know. We don't know exactly what happened, but I can tell you that to the protesters that night at that location, it didn't matter because this was just another escalation, that whether or not it was a civilian who fired the shot or anybody else, they saw this as somehow regardless because of the police presence.
Yeah, and you've got clergy kind of saying the same thing too.
Well, and I heard protesters on Wednesday night in Uptown say that they just didn't believe police, that it wasn't police. And they were just so distrustful of anything that they would say that they just wouldn't believe any other story other than that.
Which really ties back into, you know, the event that precipitated all of this, which is, you know, you have such a stark difference of accounts. You know, one saying that a man is sitting there with a book in a car and another saying he's threatening with a gun. I mean, and it's just two different planets.
I don't want to parse somebody's words here, but I'm going to. In her comments to Anderson Cooper on CNN, the mayor said, "I lean toward transparency."
She needs to lean a little harder, if that's what she's...
She told me after – I talked to her after that interview on Anderson last night, and she told me that she thinks the video should be released eventually, but then went back to the ongoing investigation part.
Yeah,
Public officials say they lean toward transparency, I mean, that's they're on the fence about it.
Well,
right.
This is the same city where Kerr Putney was asked what his idea of transparency was yesterday morning, and he said, quote, "Transparency is in the eye of the beholder," and he said it with a straight face, and every reporter in the room started laughing.
Yeah, I just think they've, you know, what struck me about this is that up until now, the city of Charlotte and its police department have said all the right things when it comes to transparency and how to deal with police community relations. And, you know, they've done the right things with these cops and barbers. They've said and done all the right things. And now when it matters, they are not, which is just baffling to me. I don't understand that.
Well, you know, that press conference yesterday was
astounding.
It was astounding would be a good word for it, because not only do you have sort of that disconnect, what you're talking about with the chief and the mayor and talking about transparency, I mean, you know, certainly from the angles that we cover, the fact that the mayor kept saying, "Hey, we're open for business and we're, you know, you're welcome.
This is usual.
Everything's great." I mean, at the same time that you have the government center packed with international media, and by the way, the office towers are half full at best, you know, it's just
and
there's
CNN
a lot of
ran a
there.
Headline last night on the bottom of the screen, "Charlotte crippled by riots."
Which is also
right. I mean, that's going way too far the other way.
Way big, far.
But yeah, it was not business as usual yesterday.
No, I agree with that. And this is something we were also talking about before the show. At a time when the city is looking for honesty and answers, and for the police and the mayor's office and anybody else, literally going through and saying, you know, this is what we know, this is what we don't know. Just somebody to try to talk the situation down. This seems like an answer that's more about optics than honesty. This is more about trying to portray that everything is just dandy. And you know what? The world knows it's not. It's okay to say right now it's not okay. And I think that's the kind of thing that we need, you know, we would benefit from with the mayor and with the chief, because otherwise it sounds to the protesters or the people who, again, feel aggrieved that they just don't, they're not paying any attention to it. They're just not listening to their concerns, and that, frankly, potentially, they don't care.
It's easy to be critical of officials who are on the hot seat right now.
It is when you make it easy.
And well, all right, there's something to be said for that. But let's talk about another aspect that has come under criticism, and that is the fact that this thing escalated from I-85 to downtown the next night, and there was a guy shot downtown on the next night, and police seemed to be standing by and not doing anything about much of anything about property damage, more about crowd control and keeping people safe. And I guess that's one way to do it. And I believe Chief Putney has said the reason that was the case is because he didn't have enough personnel. My
Correct.
Question is, did he not have enough personnel because we don't have enough police officers, or was it a scheduling logistical problem? And if we don't have enough personnel, why didn't they call in the National Guard? Because you, I think, Nick, reported on the fact that the governor offered the National Guard.
As early as 8 o'clock Wednesday morning and late yesterday afternoon, we were able to talk with sources who knew about those deliberations, about when to declare a state of emergency, which would have brought those resources that at least last night seemed to keep everything far more peaceful and under control. And our sources are telling us, and telling me specifically, that the mayor was concerned about the optics of declaring a state of emergency early in the
day. Is there something to be said for that? Because several of the protesters told some of our reporters in the field, and I played one of the cuts yesterday, that when the bicycle police were there, things were relatively calm downtown. But it was when the police in riot gear arrived that the thing escalated. Putting National Guard troops on the street would make it even worse.
Well, that makes you think back to Ferguson, I think, is a fair point. However, let's also go back to what ultimately happened last night. And there was National Guard, and there were Humvees with turret-mounted weapons mm-hmm. all over the city. But you know what? Those guys, I thought it was – it's always a strange contrast to me to see armed, you know, military soldiers in your city center. But they were just kind of hanging out. They were kind of low-key with their, you know, assault rifle slung across their chest. But – and then the people interacting with the protesters were bicycle cops. And – things were very peaceful.
Let's go back to the Carrick trial protests. I mean, I was down there that night, and the tactics that were used by the CMPD were really interesting. They allowed the protesters to go through the streets, do some minor, you know, let's call it, especially compared to the last couple of nights, minor things. You know, I saw some jump on cars. I saw some tear down some signs. These are all things that are clearly against the law, but they weren't in the broader context important that night. And the riot police, if you looked, you could always see them a few blocks away. They were always ready to deploy, but only deployed when they absolutely had to. That is not what I personally saw on Wednesday night into Thursday morning. And it sounds like last night part of the thing may be the National Guard, but it could also be that the police tried to keep a bit of a lower profile, going back to the lessons they learned after Carrick, because they did not seem to be quite as present. And I wasn't there last night, but from what I saw, because I was still following it, it didn't seem to be that directly here we are kind of
well,
approach.
I would say that the National Guard seemed to be filling the role that the riot police had filled the night before, you know, because you had the National Guard protecting the property, and so the riot police, I think, were ready to be more reactionary.
And what changed between Wednesday night and last night? Because last night was until the very end, toward curfew time, and that's another thing that protesters said was going to raise the level of heat, the fact that there was a curfew.
But remember, first there wasn't, and then there was.
But what changed? Why was it calmer?
Several hundred more people, I guess, is what the chief started with, right?
Yeah. I think one thing that shouldn't be overlooked in all of this is that there have been two types of protesters involved in these situations. Mm-hmm. Peaceful protesters who do just want to get their point across in a peaceful and constructive kind of way.
The majority of them.
But you do have this element of folks who are just looking at this as an opportunity for mayhem. They are angry, but they are willing to express that anger in destructive ways.
And they were described by the mayor as agitators, and we were led to believe that many of them may be from outside, being bussed in or flying in here from other protests, because the Black Lives Matter movement is a professional movement now, and they bring in professional people. That's the allegation. The Observer reported this morning that according to police records, the majority of the people arrested are local.
Yeah.
I don't think that's that surprising.
And I think that doesn't mean that there weren't a lot of people from out of town who were here, because I saw people who were live streaming, local people who, at one point, there was a guy who was standing apparently on top of a car yelling that he was from New York and he was here to support what's going on here. So
Charlotte, being the aspirational city that it has been since its inception, has long wanted the NC to be dropped from the word Charlotte in the national media. We have achieved that this week. And boy, were we in the spotlight all week on national media. I will say this, I don't mean to be flippant about it, but the city looked great in the shots despite the protests going on. It didn't look like other cities where we have seen rioting. Areas, inner city areas, blighted areas. This was sparkly, tree-lined, flashing signs. It was gorgeous.
And I've actually seen a story, I can't remember where I read it, where a national news media story that was pointing out that exact fact, that this is not, you know, the Rust Belt, this is not Baltimore, you know, sort of hardened urban, you know, poverty. This is, you know, happy suburbia, New South Charlotte, where people are moving to for new opportunities. And the point that that writer made, which is a good point, I think, is that if you can have this type of thing pop off in a place like Charlotte, then, you know, that's telling you something about how pervasive these frustrations are.
And it's something that a lot of people evidently don't understand, including Robert Pittenger. It seems.
Oh, boy.
Our local congressperson who represents part of this area. He was, I believe, talking to a BBC reporter about what was going on here. And here's what he said.
The grievance in their mind is the animus, the anger. They hate white people because white people are successful and they're not. I mean, yes, it is. It is a welfare state. We have spent trillions of dollars on welfare, but we put people in bondage so that they can't be all that they're capable of being.
He has since walked that back a little bit.
Wow. I mean, for
I imagine he's pretty tired from all that walking. He had a long way to go to bring that back.
If you go in the Wayback Machine, that's like a Jimmy the Greek interview. I mean, that's just a flat-out disaster, one of the worst interviews imaginable. And the fact that it happened on the BBC, international audience, and remember, Britain is the country that issued a travel advisory regarding North Carolina for another of our achievements in the past year.
I got a text from a friend yesterday saying it is now clear that you live in the most racist, homophobic state in America.
Well, and Mike, when you were talking about you know, sort of the city and the way it looks, I mean. This is nothing less than a disaster in terms of the public relations, the striving, the image making, all those things that have gone into Charlotte for so many years, and the business community in particular. I mean, just basically lies in rubble right now.
You know what I think? What this really calls out for at this very moment is for the kind of leadership that was shown back in the 70s when we had the situation with the desegregation of the schools and people bonded together, and it's become this apocryphal Charlotte story about how the Charlotte way, everyone pulls together and, you know, makes it work, where you had, you know, people from wealthy white families and poor black families all band together and make it work. This is that time again, and I'm waiting to see
because
who's
the outside
step
image is
and
what you're saying, Mike.
Yes,
that you're hearing
horrible.
From a friend.
It's horrible. I'm going to come back to the Charlotte way in a couple of seconds. I want to know if we're just kidding ourselves about this. Is this just is this the apocryphal story that we've told ourselves to make ourselves feel better? We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks come from WFAE members in Salisbury Symphony, featuring Chris Theophanidis, Richard Strauss's Don Juan, and Frederick Chu performing Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 5 tomorrow, Tickets at SalisburySymphony.org. And Duke Energy, working with local and state economic development groups to attract businesses, create jobs, and strengthen the community. More information at duke-energy.com/community. Coming up on the Diane Rehm Show, the weekly news roundup continues. Ongoing protests here over the police shooting of a black man will be discussed. Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump clashing on national security policy after the New York bombing, and lawmakers sharply questioning Wells Fargo's CEO over scam accounts. Panel of journalists joins Amy Walter for analysis of this week's top national news stories. The Diane Rehm Show in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock right here on WFAE. We will continue with our local news roundup here with our roundtable of reporters, and you can join us as well. Use the hashtag WFAE Roundup on Twitter at Charlotte Talks.
James Mina, General Director, Principal Conductor of Opera Carolina, a WFAE underwriter.
The audience of WFAE is the opera audience. They're supportive, they're engaged, they're devoted. And aligning the Opera Carolina brand with WFAE is smart business.
Underwriting on WFAE says a lot about your business. Email underwriting at WFAE.org for details.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Tom Bullock and Nick Oxner from WFAE and WBTV News, Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal, and Eric Frazier from the Charlotte Observer. The phrase we've heard repeatedly in this instance, and which I've heard for years, particularly with regard to how the city handled the civil rights movement peacefully and helped to business people voluntarily helping to integrate restaurants, was we do it the Charlotte way. We do have this history of avoiding messiness, the biggest messiness of the civil rights movement. We do seem to come together to work things out, at least we have in the past. But are we kidding ourselves in an age of social media where you can't control the message? It is viral at all times. In a city where economic advancement is difficult, if not impossible, if you're born poor. In a city where we have pretty much resegregated our schools, in a city where we evidently have a trust problem, despite all of the efforts to the contrary, between the African-American community and the police, is there really a Charlotte way?
Well, think about what you just said, Mike. I mean, start with the fact that the schools have been resegregated. That is a huge cultural, social shift that, you know, for people who don't have children in school, I don't know how much attention they've paid to that. You know, that their eyes kind of glaze over. Yeah, they're fighting about where kids are going to school again. I mean, that's a big change. And that was also a huge accomplishment for Charlotte that did make it different, that they were, that the schools were desegregated and desegregated peacefully. So I don't think it was not apocryphal. There were some legitimate accomplishments, but at the same time, this has always been a place of haves and a lot more have-nots. And those tend to be minorities who have been the have-nots.
And the New York Times, on their app on my phone this morning, I was watching a video that they shot following this African-American girl from Charlotte who is a native Charlottean around on a bus talking about this happened here, this part of the riot happened here, this part of the riot happened there, and how she was born and raised here and she doesn't recognize this. And it was clear in that video, to me at least, we have two Charlottes.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt. I mean, yeah.
And we don't acknowledge that.
Yeah, I think it's easy to sort of, you know, put the gloss in the Chamber of Commerce, put gloss on top of that and lose sight of that. But I think people have recognized that this is a problem that needs to be resolved or that needs to be dealt with. But I think this is crying out for those efforts to be redoubled. I mean, like we have that task force on economic mobility.
Right.
I think they need to take that and pump that full of whatever civic steroids.
They were supposed to be on this program this week, but they got preempted.
Right. Yeah, they need to put that into overdrive, overhaul, speed
it up. You have
things
like Project Lift. I mean,
Project Lift.
There
all
are
of those
things. I do think there are legitimate efforts going on, but first of all, these are intractable problems everywhere. That's not to say they don't have to be solved, but it is very difficult. And I think Eric's absolutely right. This has to be doubled or tripled or quadrupled. It can't just be, you know what, we've got to sort of get peace restored and then put up the marketing poster and say, we're still open for business. That, you know, there is much heavier lifting to be done.
Right. That's the exact wrong thing to do.
Talk to me a minute about how city officials have handled this publicly in terms of communicating to the people of Charlotte while this was going on. I was watching WBTV's anchor team Wednesday night on Bounce, your sub-channel, and they were saying, and I said similar things on this program about getting the governor on here, but they were saying that it would be nice if the mayor or the police chief would spend time on local media as much time as they were spending on CNN, Fox, MSNBC. Is that a fair criticism?
I absolutely believe so. To be fair now, the governor did come on Wednesday night and talk with us by phone.
And the mayor was here yesterday.
Yes, and she gave us 20 minutes last night to talk. But that being said, they are spending an absolutely inordinate amount of time. I think we got maybe 3 minutes with Kerr Putney. Molly Grantham talked to Kerr Putney yesterday, and he did a round of local interviews, each one for about 3 minutes. But he's been on Megyn Kelly and Anderson Cooper and every other
And he left one of those shows because he had to go.
Wednesday.
Megyn Kelly.
Wednesday night, but then he was back on
last night.
All of them last night and far more than the 3 minutes of local media.
So let's talk about this. Because there was very little local media during the height of these protests and riots.
Well, hang on a second. I think you need to clarify by what you mean by that.
I'm going to.
Okay.
Let me do it. On Wednesday night, I had to go. If you don't have Time Warner Cable and you don't know that WBTV has a Bounce channel and you don't have an antenna, you can't get the Bounce channel. I don't know what some of the other stations did, but I flipped around and they were carrying network programming. You guys break in for a thunderstorm. You can't break in for protests and riots where property damage is occurring and where people are being shot. I mean, what's up with that? You have to watch CNN and MSNBC and Fox News to see shots from WBTV, WCNC, Channel 46, WSOC-TV from their helicopters because you can't see them on your local station? What the heck is wrong with you people?
I'll say that we, in addition to carrying on Bounce and the live stream, we are live streaming always online as well. We, on Wednesday night, spent...
So turn in your broadcast license, because obviously your live stream and your apps are more important than your television
station.
Well,
that's not true, but we also...
Yes, it is.
We spent probably a cumulative total of an hour simulcasting what we were doing on Bounce and online on CBS News. But I think you raise a fair question that we continue to have internal discussions about as well.
Yeah, I'm not speaking for the stations. Just as a viewer, I was shocked that I kept flipping around and I didn't see much coverage from any of the main three. I'm not sure. I don't have a timeline of who cut in and who didn't.
And yet,
right. It was mostly national cable networks that were sticking with the coverage.
And
constantly.
Yet, you guys were out. And this may be, I'm really angry at this because I've been in broadcasting for my entire adult life. And this is why I got into it, because I really do believe that radio and television stations have an obligation to do what the license says, broadcast in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. And if there was a moment in Charlotte where that is true, it was what happened on Tuesday and Wednesday night. And it must be terribly frustrating for people in the field like you and your wife, who is also a reporter for WBTV, and all the other reporters from all the other stations around town, that you're out there and you're not on the air.
Our reporters were on the air, in different ways.
At least you – I will say this. To their credit, you preempted all the programming on your Bounce channel, that's wonderful.
And ran crawls on CBS and simulcasted far more than just minutes at a time.
But if there had been a thunderstorm during this, you would have broken into network programming on CBS.
Likely.
Okay. Let's move on. Mr. Stumpf went to Washington. This week to appear before the
Senate. It feels like that was 100 years ago.
He went before the Senate Banking Committee. They wanted to hear from the CEO of Wells Fargo about the bank's sales practices. How did it go?
Yeah, not too well, I think, would be a euphemistic response to that. I think most people have probably heard the highlight or lowlight of Senator Elizabeth Warren telling Mr. Stumpf that he had engaged in gutless leadership. And the interesting part to me is, you know, this committee is not typically singing from the same hymn book, but they were when John Stumpf appeared because he was unprepared.
I thought it was funny that he had, well, not funny, but interesting, that he had his hand bandaged. He had had some accident, and he...
That was the mildest of his wounds, right?
Yeah, he left needing a whole lot more bandage.
Yeah, prior to his appearance, John Stumpf said that the cross-selling practices that resulted in bogus accounts being opened in the names of customers who never asked for those accounts was the result of rogue employees, and he had 5,300 of them fired. But then, in front of the Senate Banking Committee, he took a slightly different approach.
I am deeply sorry that we failed to fulfill on our responsibility to our customers, to our team members, and to the American public. I want to make very clear that we never directed nor wanted our team members to provide products and services to customers that they did not want. I accept full responsibility.
And that did not sit well with Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren. She just wasn't having it.
Okay, so you haven't resigned. You haven't returned a single nickel of your personal earnings. You haven't fired a single senior executive. Instead, evidently, your definition of accountable is to push the blame to your low-level employees. It's gutless leadership. You should resign. You should give back the money that you took while this scam was going on, and you should be criminally investigated.
She sounds like me a moment ago.
And I feel just as beat up as John Stumpf did.
So, what about that?
Well, I mean, there are so many things that leap out at you. First of all, 5 years. Of this going on.
Yep. Fives are important here. 5 years, more than 5,000 employees. Like, it's crazy. And the idea that you finally take responsibility for it, which is great, because if you say you've got 5,200 rogue employees that you had to fire, that begs into question your management practices, full stop, let alone the fact that you praise your own bank for being focused not on the classic kind of Wall Street investment banking aspect, but this retail, personal, old-school banking aspect. It was just stunning.
Well, and that's the other thing I was going to say. A lot of people have pointed this out, and it's absolutely right, which is the average citizen can understand this. Oh, the bank has opened up an account for me that I didn't ask for. You know, this is not like trying to figure out the Great Recession, although people were obviously very mad about that. But, you know, derivatives and all those things are a little bit murkier. This is very clear. Just you're creating dummy accounts and you're benefiting from it and you're making my life worse. Why in the world would I trust you? It's very simple.
The bank has already paid $185 million in fines. Prosecutors in Charlotte and San Francisco are looking into the bank's activities further. He's testified now before the Senate Banking Committee, and some are insisting that he take no salary or bonus, Mr. Stumpf, this year, and that the bank claw back compensation given to an executive who retired last year, just as this was kind of breaking, and she was the one who would have overseen, I believe, this aspect.
$125 million is what's being discussed as a clawback.
What is the likelihood of that happening? What is the likely? What is
as Stumpf kept saying, that depends on the board.
The board that he's the chairman of course.
Yes,
and it points out, you know, the thing that people have such a problem with corporate America, and you know, which is that it's this sort of insular, you know, situation where they're all patting each other's backs and raising each other's salaries.
Ms. Cho, who is a former government official, is on the board of Wells Fargo, and she's married to a senator.
Well, and remember,
Ed McConnell, I believe.
Yes, Mr. McConnell.
Yes, remember that through the whole recession, all of the fallout from that. And this is yet another example. Low-level employees get in trouble. Mm-hmm. No one at the top gets in trouble. And that's why people get so frustrated. And even when an employee is perhaps a high-level employee, perhaps resigns or is forced out, often they leave with tens of millions of dollars in compensation. And so when people say that the consumer for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau may not be necessary, I think you look at something like this and you have to say, wait a minute.
Elizabeth Warren points out fairness and accountability in what she said to him. Donald Trump is doing that on the campaign trail. His numbers are rising, and fairness and accountability are what happened in Charlotte this week. That's what that's all about.
Oh, yeah.
We don't have any of it.
Ultimately, yeah. And, you know, unfortunately, we don't have a Senate panel that can, you know, sort of haul our local officials in and demand accountability like you could in this case with John Stumpf. But, yeah, I mean, you're right. That is what this comes down to, people who are in positions of public trust or leading, you know, large multinational corporations that require or are asking for public trust, when things go wrong, they do need to explain themselves and hold themselves accountable.
And this kind of cynicism is crippling us all over the country.
Oh, yeah.
Because there is so little faith over and over again when you see this play out and people just sort of throw up their hands and say, you know what, it's not even worth me voting or paying attention because this is what I get.
And you hear about, and I don't know how, we don't know that this is true, that the sales pressures at Wells Fargo were such that these people felt they were, one person said she had to report hourly on the numbers of products that she had sold that hour. When you have that kind of pressure and you file 5,300, you fire 5,300 people, and yet.
And what's driving that, Mike? What's driving
profits, that?
Profits,
money.
Stock price.
Yes,
absolutely.
Stock price. And the woman who's in charge of all this retires at the height of this, when it's just being uncovered, with how much?
$125 million.
And you look at that and you think, $125 million? Who needs that kind of money?
Well, those 5,000 fired employees sure could use some of it.
But yes.
Hope she opened up a new Wells Fargo account to keep
so, yes. At the beginning of this week, we all thought that the big story would be Charlotte City Council's refusal to repeal the ordinance that led the legislature to enact HB 2. They had been told if they did, the legislature would repeal the law. Mayor Roberts said no. Now what?
Well, obviously a lot of things have happened since then, but I would like to remind people that 300 years ago, which was last Sunday, the Charlotte Chamber and tourism leaders called a press conference to try and make this proposal work. It had already failed in May. The city council had rejected this idea of a mutual repeal. And now I don't see anything happening certainly before Election Day, and I'm not so sure much is going to happen after Election Day.
It's worth pointing out that it's not just Mayor Roberts said no. It's that according to multiple sources I've talked with, that there was a vote of an agreement Friday a week ago of seven members of the council to repeal the city's non-discrimination ordinance after that offer had been made, and that two of them, Councilwoman Julie Isolt and Mayor Pro Tem Vi Lyles, changed their vote under pressure from State Representative Becky Carney, who didn't, as we've reported, didn't want the council to repeal the non-discrimination ordinance because then HB 2 would be repealed and Democrats need that as a wedge issue. And that is according to a legislative Democrat that I have talked with.
And the Observer wrote an editorial suggesting that the city not repeal the ordinance, which is exactly what they did. They didn't
do it. Well, I guess in the editorial board, the way we see it is that so much has been, so much has been done and said that at the end of the day, the city council would have been selling out the people that they went through all this trouble to try and protect.
Next week, we'll talk about ice cream socials, I promise. Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Nick Oxner, WBTV News, Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, and Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. Thank you all for the hour.